Okay, we're going to get Linda's take in just a moment to that Chinese UFO picture that has been going all around the world lately. And then we'll have conversations with Linda when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, what did you think of that Chinese photo that's been all over the place?
I find this a fascinating story because I have had contact with an American Chinese businessman. He goes back and forth between Hangzhou and Shanghai every month. And he very quickly emailed me. And one of the things that has been impressive in his communication is that he sent me two photographs, one of which, if you go to the July 20th Earth Files new Hangzhou UFO photo and airport staff interview, you will see a photograph that has not existed anywhere else. It was an image submitted to me from this American Chinese businessman who is trying to help, and he's asked to remain anonymous, but he said, quote, "The photo is real per my trusted employee, taken between 8 and 9:30 p.m. on July 7th, 2010, within 25 kilometers of the Chaoshan Airport in Hangzhou. The buildings match the area. The lights out so early in the evening is very common, as power costs more in China than the USA. Please do not use my name." And he's referring on those lights to the fact that the photograph in the July 20th Earth Files shows this very odd light, and it shows the houses, and they don't have any lights on. So he's trying to explain why the houses in this picture don't have lights in their windows like we would expect in the U.S., because they shut off their power. And he also has sent me a second one that I have not posted yet, but I want to just go over something that I think is quite fascinating, because I have been getting a lot of information, even though it's very difficult to find anyone who can speak English in Hangzhou. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to get an interview with an eyewitness. But the spokesman for the Chaoshan Airport in Hangzhou said, and this was a quote, they came out in a very credible article. This is now the airport spokesman, quote, "There was an unknown object seen in the skies over the airport. So according to our regulations, we had to close the airspace. Aircraft movements were suspended from 8:45 p.m. to 9:45 p.m. on July 7th, 2010. And George, that means if they halted airport traffic at 8:45, that whatever was being seen and photographed, it must have occurred before 8:45. And that might be very consistent with this photograph that the businessman, actually two photographs, one of which I have posted. And then when you go to, I got an entire Shanghai newspaper. I have the whole newspaper, was delivered to me. And it is the front page headline with a July 7th, 2010 identified Hangzhou UFO photograph. And this is the one that is the odd rectangle, and you can see some of the buildings. Well, one of the interesting educations from the Chinese-American businessman is that in Hangzhou, it is one of the few cities in which they use either lightning rods or now decoration, but they are silver spheres, usually with one ring around the bottom silver sphere, and they rise up 2 or 3 feet from roofs. In this front page newspaper art photo, you can see one of those lightning rod metal pieces with the spheres and the ring rising from one of those buildings. So we know that at least the front page newspaper photo is in Hangzhou. It is identified as July 7th. It is somewhat like the image submitted to me privately by the American Chinese businessman in that same article. I think that when you put together what the airport spokesman gave in an interview for BonLive.com television, and I have a hot link in my Earth Files report to that full interview that is translated with the airport spokesman, that there is no question that something very unusual happened over the airport and probably before the airport in another part of Hangzhou, which is what these other photos relate to.
And, you know, they keep saying it was military application. I can't see that.
No, and then one more very important piece. I received a video link to another Shanghai television news report going all the way back to the first week of March. And it is video in which there are two bright objects sort of near the horizon, but up in the sky. And they start out, they're about a quarter of an inch wide, these two bright spheres. And then over a period of maybe 40 seconds, they come almost together and merge. They don't completely merge. But this is came in an email in which two men have been communicating, the businessman and the fellow who is Hong Kong exopolitics, Neil Gould. He said that one staff working in the airport mentioned that a huge, long, strip-shaped object appeared on radar. This is very important. Appeared on radar at about 9,600 feet past the northern sky of where the airlines at the, over the airport, on the northern end of the airport. And that the people at the airport regarded this as a UFO, that's the acronym that is used, after eliminating all the possibilities, and it is upgraded as top secret. Now, all of this has been unfolding in a Chinese government in which underneath all of these issues of secrecy and policy and geopolitical relationships with the rest of the world, that the Chinese population and residents have been photographing and reporting all kinds of strange aerial phenomena in the Hangzhou, Shanghai area for a long time, including March. And I am fascinated that there are these strange metal rods up on top of all of these roofs, whether or not that has anything to do with why something would be focusing in that area, I do not know. But I do not think that we have heard the end of Hangzhou when it comes to these unusual lights. And if I can get somebody there who was an eyewitness, this is what I'm trying to do, who will speak through an English translator that I now have firmed up, then I'll try to bring Coast a firsthand account from Hangzhou through a translator.
Super. Now we'll go to the phones, Billings, Montana. Scott, you get us started on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Scotty.
Hi, George. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
I want to thank you both for the great work you do.
Thank you.
Just a couple things about the cattle mutilations up in the Montana area and also the crop circles. And one other thing. First off, did you hear about there's been some research in England about the effect of pharmaceutical antidepressants that are on brine shrimp, that the pharmaceuticals are actually passing into the ocean and causing shrimp to act weirdly?
Yes. The whole contamination of waters around the planet, especially the northern hemisphere, from pharmaceuticals that are getting into everything. And one of the big issues that I did reports on just, I think it must have been 8 or 10 years ago, was the amount of PCBs that they were measuring in the fat of polar bears, and that there are issues about sex being affected in some of the animals where they think that some of this contamination in the water could be affecting the endocrine system and therefore affecting the whole male-female sexual differentiation. And that could be a bigger problem than any of us know eventually, because it's really a huge problem if the waters are so polluted.
Yeah, I heard about it on the BBC World Service. I hadn't heard anything in the American media about it. Also, about the cattle mutilations, I don't know if you ever read the book Mystery Stalks the Prairie by Keith Wolverton, who was a Cascade County sheriff.
Oh, yes, I talked with Keith Wolverton, and I talked with the woman who wrote the book with him, And this was back in 1979 when I started on A Strange Harvest. That book had come out only, I think, a year or two before. So I had a fresh copy from them and also talked with Keith Wolverton, the deputy sheriff in the Cascade County Sheriff's Office, about the fact that they had photographs in Mystery Stalks the Prairie, and he had them in his sheriff's office, of the serrated edge that they found on several mutilated animals, that as if you would take pinking shears and you would cut the hide. And I have photographs from Keith Wolverton and from other places. This has been found many places where it looks exactly like pinking shears that would be used in something like cutting cloth. But this is in hide, in animals in which there is no blood, there are no tracks, with the same pattern of excisions. And we all have always wondered, what in the world is the instrument that would make this very regular pinking shear cut with absolutely no blood? And under a microscope, when pathologists have looked at that, one of the Oregon lab reports on one of the serrated edges was that the excision had been cut with high heat.
All right, we go now to Iuka, Mississippi. It's Chris's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Chris.
Hello, George. Hello, Linda.
Hi.
I'm a big fan. I'm down on my knees. I'm not worthy, you know, all that good stuff. But anyway, Linda, I'm really impressed with your work, and I was wondering, especially with the crop circles that you're talking about now, with the different geometric formations and things in them, and the newest ones, has anyone ever thought to maybe take samples of those and look at them, not only cell-wise, but maybe an electron microscope, and seeing if the maybe magnetism, radiation, or other things have affected the plants in certain ways to maybe cause them to form in these certain ways or destabilize them in any certain way? I have one more question after that.
Yeah, I have been working with biophysicist W.C. Levengood since 1994 on exactly those issues. Mm-hmm. And I hope you will find value in getting my fourth book, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, because there's a whole big science section in there in which, right in the beginning, the whole biophysical background of W.C. Levengood is a man who did patents on seed developments, and he was very interested in looking at what was the impact on the seed heads in crop formations. That's what first attracted him. And the more he studied under a microscope, looking at all kinds of levels of metabolism, including a test that he came up with having to do with the respiration of plants, measuring baselines in all cereal crops and grasses, and then with a baseline established, taking and gathering crop formations from the plant, or gathering plants from crop formations, and then seeing what was the metabolism like in those plants that had been exposed to something. And out of all of this work that he has done, of which a lot of the photomicrographs are in my book, he has come to the conclusion that the only physical element that he can, working backwards from the impact in the plants, he hypothesizes that a spinning plasma vortex, which means that you've got negatively charged and positively charged ions that are spinning, come down from high in the atmosphere and interact with the various cereal crops and grasses to create these formations, leaving very regular changes in the metabolism of the plants, in the seeds, changes in the soil. And we have a huge body of hard physical evidence now of biophysical and biochemical changes that no one could ever produce with boards and string. And I think that the work of W.C. Levengood is absolutely crucial to understanding why the worldwide crop formation phenomenon, all the way from the beginning, going all the way back to Warminster in the 1970s in England and coming up to the present day, in which it is reported in many countries around the world and in both hemispheres, including Australia and New Zealand, that we are dealing with something that seems to have reactive intelligence. And in that reactive intelligence, part of its dialogue, if you want to call it that, is creating crop formations that often have embedded in them, in the ones that are truly fluid and miraculous. They sometimes have embedded a mathematical language that perhaps if we were bright enough, we might be able to string all of the formations around the world for 30 years together and come up with something that would be a mathematical whole language. But no one has had the ability to do that.
Wow.
Okay. Follow up there, Chris?
Yeah, I've got one more thing in a related question, okay? Here in Mississippi, we have something on the Natchez Trace. It's a national landmark, so to speak. It's a place called Witch Dance, okay? And it's supposed to be a place where witches during Native American times touched down, and they danced around something of a fire or something like that. But everywhere their feet touched, okay, there lays a bare spot on the ground that looks like a giant footprint, okay, larger than average, okay? But they've been there in the same location for over 300 years. Even Andrew Jackson marveled at them as he traveled down the Natchez Trace in 1814. And I was just wondering, they're still there. You can still see them. And I was saying, if you ever come through this area or something like that, would love for you to look at them. I've even had a friend of mine that's a dean at the University of Mississippi Chemistry Lab, and he's taken some soil samples under there and found some unusual discrepancies with them as far as acids and stuff that are in there that won't allow grasses to grow. But this is a legend that goes back to pre-American, pre-colonial times.
Can you take photographs and send them to me through email to earthfiles@earthfiles.com?
I can attempt to. I'm blind, but I can get somebody who can, okay?
Yeah, I would.
And I would love to show them to you. It's been on the National Historic Spots, landmarks and stuff on the Trace, and it's really unusual. So I'd like for you to kind of take a look at it, because I think it deals in with these crop formations and aliens and the different things I've been hearing you talk about over the last several years.
Well, a lot of people think that there is some kind of a link to what we'll call the extraterrestrial biological entity phenomena. But the truth is, in crop formations, the only persistent and common denominator for all of these decades has always been mysterious lights, and they are usually 6 to 12 inches in diameter. And one astronomer said, Linda, I think that we are dealing with a programmed plasma, a plasma of unknown origin, that another intelligence is programming with zeros and ones to monitor and perhaps make the crop formations and send information back to whoever has programmed the plasma.
And we'll be back with final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll talk a little bit about miraculous moments, followed by those open lines on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come right back, we'll take final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe. Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Let's take final phone calls with Linda. Linda, before we do that, any more travel schedule events or conferences for you?
Yes, I'm going to be in Brazil in September. Hmm. And I'm going to be in Rio and Sao Paulo, and I'm going to be speaking on crop formations is going to be my subject, and Michio Kaku will be a speaker, and I understand Rupert Sheldrake from England on morphogenic fields. So I'm very much looking forward to doing that.
And give Rupert our best, by the way. You know, he was stabbed at a conference a year and a half ago.
That's right.
Right in the leg.
I know. It's terrible.
Yeah. Okay. To the calls we go. Paul is in Tallahassee, Florida. Go ahead, Paul. Thanks for calling.
George, I'm a longtime listener. I don't know if you remember or not, but I did call you several months ago when you had Nick Pope on. And I was in the Navy and had an encounter south of Puerto Rico back in the early 70s.
Yes.
Okay. Something to go along with that. Linda, how are you this evening?
Hello.
I have
And turn your radio down. Hey, Paul, turn your radio down a little bit, okay?
Okay, I got it.
There you go.
I don't want to sound strange, but your crop circles. I had an encounter when I was younger, and I dream about the inside of some kind of a craft all the time. And I don't know if you're familiar with GPS and waypoints, but if you take some of these crop circles, which I have done, and lay them on a sheet of Mylar and connect different points on the geometric shapes and formations, they give you coordinates, and you lay the Mylar on top of a star chart, and it'll give you different star points, exact locations of stars and portals that these beings transport from one point to another.
Well, there are a lot. I think there are as many hypotheses as there are grains of sand on a beach some days. And yeah. We really don't know. We do find some, I would say, for example, Barbary Castle, 1991, going back to the kind of the beginning of some of the astonishing patterns, in which you had Gerald Hawkins, the astronomer and mathematician, who studied Barbary Castle and came up with five new geometry theorems that were not in university textbooks out of the crop formation. It is at that level of sophistication and pushing the human brain way beyond where we are that I think that some of the most special crop formations have been in that, they've been at that level in terms of having their impact on thinking and on a few scientists who have been willing to study them. And that intrigues me. We don't have bottom line answers, but we definitely in some formations are dealing with very sophisticated mathematical minds.
John from Fort Myers, Florida, sends a text in for you, wants to know if you have ever seen a strange or unusual craft, Linda.
Oh, yes. I had a huge one of the boomerangs fly low over me in Aurora, Colorado, one night back in 1986, and I still can remember trying to hear any sound, and it was the complete and total silence of something that was enormous flying over me and low with all kinds of structure on it. My mind could not place what I was seeing right above me that was moving slowly, could not place it. And I think that the mind goes into a kind of neutral gear at those moments where you're trying to understand what it is that you're seeing, and your brain cannot come up with a slot for it, and you stand with your mouth open and your mind just kind of in neutral. And I know that has happened to me even when I've been in England, and one of those helicopters have flown down so low over me at like 30 feet, and I have a camera on my shoulder, and you're so astonished that even with a camera that is ready to go, you don't grab it immediately. And I think that affects a lot of people when they're faced with this kind of phenomena. And I have seen the orange gold lights. I have seen the flickering mirror lights close to the heads of crops. And when you see them, when you see some of these phenomena, then you understand very much and have a heartfelt feeling for people that I'm interviewing who are trying so hard to come up with words to explain what is often indescribable in normal human life.
Let's go to our international line now. Linda Angelina is Ontario, Canada. Go ahead, Angelina.
Good evening, George and Linda.
Hi.
George, I've been listening to you now for 4 years religiously every night.
Well, thank you.
And I love your show, and I think you're better than Art Bell.
No.
Yes.
Different.
No more. You're more diverse. You got more balls. I just wanted to say to you, George, first, I have a few things. I think JC was Oscar. And Linda, I want to thank you for all the work you did for the cattle mutilations.
Thank you.
And I believe that's what the eye floaters are, is the carbon from the lasers that you talk about finding in the cattle mutilations. But when it comes to...
Can I just give you a fast postscript?
Yeah.
We have never found carbon at the excisions of mutilations. That has been one of the anomalies for decades. When you look at the excisions in mutilated animals under a microscope, and if it has been something like a laser, it wouldn't matter whether you had laser surgery or a horse had laser surgery. Under a microscope, you should find what look like pepper grains, the carbon residue, because we're carbon life forms. But when it comes to the animal mutilations and the findings in pathology, that there's definitely been heat, that collagen and hemoglobin have been cooked, but there is no carbon residue, that means it was not a laser, as we understand lasers, that was used as the cutting instrument. And in fact, before he died, pathologist and hematologist John Altshuler in Denver said to me that he really wondered if the cutting instrument was actually working with sound frequency and not light.
Oh, I see. I thought you did find it. But now I know what that residue is, and I'm sure that's what is causing the eye floaters in people. But I just wanted to say that when it comes to, flying saucers and everything, we have drones out there, planes that are manned by not a single person, and we're flying them from 3,000 miles away and dropping bombs on people. And you know how when computers first came out, they were huge things, now they're really tiny little things? I was personally being watched in a park by a dragonfly, and it was around me for half an hour. When I started to get a really good look at this dragonfly, I saw that its body was not a normal shape of a dragonfly, but instead it was three little round discs. Black, like you get little batteries. And I tried to look at it better with my binoculars, but the thing would zip and zag all, you know, so much that I was unable to look at it with my binoculars. But if we have drones like that and a black ops budget, for so much money for 60 years, I personally myself think that they are creating all this.
Well, you know what? There's no doubt we might have drones like that, Linda, little ones.
Yes, I'm not at all disagreeing that there could be in 2010 insect-like little drones that are photographing in Iran and Iraq and all over the place. But in terms of the evolution of the worldwide animal mutilation with the same MO, the same bloodless pattern of excisions, no tracks around the animals, not even the animal's own tracks, going all the way back into the 20th century. And then you have all of the testimony of sheriffs largely off the record and ranchers largely on the record about the orange lights and the lens-shaped silver craft that they have seen in pastures where the mutilated animals are found. That's decades of testimony. So you cannot say and dismiss the global animal mutilations as some modern paramilitary or military operation. It doesn't match the facts of history.
Okay, next we go to George in Leipzig, Germany on the wild card line. Hey, George, you're calling from a long way out. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you for providing us with such an interesting show.
Sure,
it's Leipzig. It's the older East
Leipzig.
Germany.
Okay.
And I do listen from time to time. Today, I'm just calling about the question of the bee population. And despite what's been said in interesting comments by people like Richard Hoagland and by Linda today, what I tend to go by is the price of honey in the shops. And all I can say about that is that whereas it rose a year or two ago and held to a kind of plateau, in recent months it's been coming off a little bit in special office here and there. And I wonder whether the bee population is perhaps not as sparse as we're led to believe.
Oh, no, it's really a serious situation. And looking at the price of honey where you are, I don't know who your local growers of honey might be, because some local growers have been faring better than the large commercial, but it's the large commercial beekeepers that are largely responsible for all the berries and the vegetables and almonds and so forth in the United States and England. And Jerry Hayes, that I did the interview with about the current situation, he had talked with one of your bee representatives in England about the fact that your country is facing the same problem we are, with an average of approximately 30% in the colony collapse. That means colonies that are disappearing or collapsing and they're not functioning. And that comes to the question, how can the beekeepers, whether they are individuals, but especially the larger commercial ones, how can they sustain a continual, persistent 30% loss every year? And this is now facing another issue, is will there be another shoe to drop? We have had clearly viruses, pesticides, the Varroa mites, all of this has ganged up on the honeybees in addition to other things out there. If there is one more shoe that drops, will we then see a plummeting of another 60%? And if we finally, all of the countries are facing an issue of what happens to a declining pollinator population that we can't get back, then what does happen to food supplies that we have been dependent upon? Those are real issues for the United Kingdom and for the United States.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to Vero Beach, Florida now. First-time caller, Randy, let's get you in. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Hi, Randy. Yep.
Yeah, I'm calling from Vero Beach. I just wanted to say, this is only the second time I've listened to you, but I'd sent Linda an email on the 14th of July, and she replied, said she'd get back with me. I sent her my phone number, but I just listening to this, I had to call. I had an incident in 1967. I was in helicopter flight school down at Fort Walters, Texas, little town, Mineral Wells, which is about 35, 40 miles north of Stephenville, where all the orange lights and all were seen the last couple of years.
That's right.
I was driving back in my car from taking a girl home that lived in a small town called Lipan, L-I-P-A-N, down Highway 281. I was hit with a bluish-white beam of light. And right after that, a saucer, silvery color saucer, and I always said it was 25 to 30 foot in diameter, flew over the car, shot out an orangish-red ball of light about the size of a basketball, landed in the field. This was all farm country at the time. And the next thing I remember after that, I was standing outside my car with the car door open. I had been going 70 miles an hour, and I was frozen. I couldn't move, and the saucer is sitting off the left-hand side of the road only 40 or 50 feet from me, and it was wobbling about 3 or 4 feet off the ground. And I'm trying to talk, and I was trying to move my mouth, and nothing was coming out. And the only thing I was thinking about, I used to carry a .22 rifle in the back of the car. Me and a buddy used to go out plinking around the area. And I was thinking I needed to get it, but I couldn't move. About that time, the saucer started taking up real slowly, and then it just blinked out. But I told people this story for years, and I never wanted to contact anybody, but I've just finally come to the point that I thought I ought to tell a story.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I'm curious if you've had any vivid dreams since then.
If I ever had what?
Any vivid dreams about that? Anything more that has come to you in vivid dreams?
Oh, I have many, many incidences have happened to me. That's what I sent in the email to you. I don't know if it was you that replied or you had an assistant do it or whatever, and I knew you just had the convention out there, but I would really like to talk to you if you could give me a call. And I think I could blow your mind with all these other incidences that have happened to me.
Well, why don't you send another email and mention this? Because I have been so much on the road.
I understand.
It's been very hard to keep up with email. But,
okay, we'll do that. And you don't have an assistant. You do it all yourself.
I do it all myself, which I hope you will laugh at me. Because I had come back from two trips and then went to MUFON for a week and was concentrating, that I realized tonight that I pulled up the wrong script when I was talking to you about the lights in Guy's Cliff. And I was supposed to talk about Barley and Lidington and then the light. So that's how busy I have been.
No wonder you were going long during that segment.
It was the script that I had originally used in a first edit, and then I had redone that edit, and I was laughing at myself because I have literally been doing so many different stories and having to keep it all straight, and I love it. But that's why I would encourage you now, sir, to send me another email, and I will follow up.
And I was giving you the softball, Linda. I threw you the line about the wheat field, remember?
And I was actually going to place all of those lights, no matter where they are, up in Hessdalen in Norway, where I spent a week with scientists, or in England, the mysterious lights in the fields there, or here is a gentleman describing one of what they call the basketball reddish-orange ones. And there was, when I was doing research for mysterious lights and crop circles, that I came across one of these books called Unexplained Mysteries of the 20th Century by Janet and Colin Board.
That is a great, great book, by the way.
It is, and they have this fascinating story.
Linda Moulton Howe, we'll talk to you in August, the end of August. I can't believe how fast this year is going. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.